I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. A happy Friday to you. And for those celebrating Eid Mubarak, the Muslim holiday Eid al-Fitr begins today. For those of you who've been fasting through the daylight hours for the past month, now begins a month of celebrating. So to quote my mom, eat. Speaking of eating, in a few minutes we're going to meet a climate scientist who's changed what he eats to help bring down his carbon footprint. He and his family have also dialed back their driving, their flying, a whole bunch of stuff that a lot of us might be able to do as well. But we're going to start with a little bit of why we might want to do that. It's news about Antarctica and a new report that it's melting way faster than it was just a few years ago. The World's Carolyn Beeler is here from our Livable Planet desk. The news is pretty daunting, isn't it?
It is, Marco. The news is that Antarctica is melting three times faster now than it was a decade ago, which means it's sending more than 200 billion tons of ice into the ocean per year. That corresponds to about a half a millimeter of sea level rise a year just from Antarctica. That's not including Greenland or anything like that. And it's largely coming from just two huge Antarctic glaciers.
I have to imagine this is a really big deal.
It is. This is the most definitive number we have yet on changes to the rate of ice melt in Antarctica. It was done by 80 scientists from all over the world, and it combined two dozen recent measurements of ice melt to give an especially comprehensive look at what's going on down there. That being said, it's important to note that just because we've noted a tripling of the rate of ice melt in the past decade, that doesn't mean that's what's going to be happening for the next decade. So this shows the past, not necessarily the future. But one of the report's authors, Pippa Whitehouse, pointed out even current projections for sea level rise are worrisome for a lot of us.
We have projections going through to 2100, and actually the sea level rise we're going to see is 50, 60 centimetres probably. And that is not only going to impact people who live close to the coast, but actually when we have major storm surges and flooding events, it's going to be exacerbated.
So Carolyn, as you said, this study is especially comprehensive and its results are startling to say the least. But I feel like there's a new scary news story about melting ice and sea level rise practically every month, maybe even more frequently than that. For example, this is a compendium of ominous headlines just from our show. The massive West Antarctic ice sheet is starting to collapse.
The glacier's melt rate has doubled since the 1990s.
The ice sheets aren't melting in a gradual, linear fashion.
Antarctica is losing ice twice as fast as it was just 4 years ago.
The ice shelf could become quite unstable.
When we hear all these stories, do we just become numb to them? Do we bury our heads in the sand? Or does this actually help understand climate change better?
There's more and more work being done in the fields of psychology and cognitive science looking at how we interpret and react to climate change news. And I think the first thing to point out, Marco, is that we as humans have not evolved to get super worked up about problems where the worst impacts may be decades in the future, or where the worst impacts are going to be felt far away from where we live right now. So it's kind of hard to make us care about this type of thing in general. I interviewed environmental psychologist Lorraine Whitmarsh from Cardiff University about this.
Climate change has all the hallmarks of an issue which is difficult for people to engage with psychologically because it's kind of global, it's long term, it has a lot of uncertainties attached to it, it's very complex, as well as this issue of it kind of having quite threatening implications for tackling it in terms of people's lifestyles.
So if this is not something we're predisposed to caring about, does hearing this news over and over affect us?
So interestingly, a lot of the studies that have been done looking at how we interpret negative news that might impact us are from the realm of public health. And what that work shows is that fear tactics only work to spur us to action or get us to care in very specific contexts. So contexts in which we know exactly what we can do to reduce the risk we're being told about, so giving up smoking, for example, and where making a change in our life isn't really threatening to our lifestyles. So neither of these is true about climate change. And so Whitmarsh says if we hear scary stories or campaigns that use fear tactics about climate change, we often tune out.
This is why it's really difficult to use fear for climate change, because actually, individually, our sense of being able to tackle climate change is pretty low. Secondly, the sorts of things that we're being asked to do are often things people don't really want to change or give up.
So what does convince us to change our behaviors?
Well, it's not images of polar bears on melting ice caps, because we can't relate to that. It doesn't relate to our lives. What does tend to work is understanding how climate change might impact our families, our favorite spot on the beach, our jobs. And in terms of things that get us to actually take action about climate change, the research says what's key is to appeal to our own self-interests. Here's Whitmarsh again.
I would say sometimes we don't even need to talk about climate change to persuade people to take action. The most effective way to get people to change behavior is to appeal to what is important to them.
So, for example, the research shows that if you want people to save energy, tell them it's going to save them money. If you want them to eat less meat, tell them it's good for their health. If you want people to cut down on how much they drive, tell them it's going to be good for their neighborhood.
The World's Livable Planet reporter, Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much for this.
You're welcome, Marco.
So what exactly can one person do if they want to lower their carbon footprint?
Quitting planes was the biggest for me. Freeganism actually was the second biggest. That was getting some of my food from, you know, the food that supermarkets throw away, becoming vegetarian, bicycling more and driving less, composting, and then driving on waste vegetable oil and growing some of my own food.
Peter Kalmus is a climate scientist in California.
I'm using 1/10 as much fossil fuel as when I started out making these changes. In my mind, this is the most urgent crisis facing humanity. So it feels great to be doing everything I can about it.
You're a climate scientist, Peter, and we should mention you weren't involved in the Antarctica study we were talking about earlier on the show. But obviously you've known for a long time about carbon emissions and how they hurt the Earth. Was there a specific moment, though, or a breaking point that you reached that made you decide to change your lifestyle?
Right. Well, I've had sort of a long path toward becoming a climate scientist. I started out in astrophysics, and I started learning about climate change, and it was kind of a really unpleasant wake-up call for me. And I kept reading more and more about it, and I eventually realized I had to switch into atmospheric science and start studying it full-time. What caused me to change my life so much? You know, I think a lot of people feel the need for urgent change and aren't really aware of how to go about doing it. And I was certainly like that for several years. And I was kind of shaking people by the proverbial lapels and telling them we need to stop burning fossil fuel. And then I realized, hey, you know, I'm not actually doing that myself. So maybe I can reduce my own use of fossil fuel.
Well, you wrote a book about your whole experience changing your lifestyle called Being the Change. And we just heard that doom and gloom descriptions of climate change don't actually work to make people change their behavior. But examples of how actions that will help the climate can also help us personally, can make us change our behavior. Was that part of the reason you decided to write your book instead of just changing your lifestyle?
Right. Well, that was one of them, is that I didn't see this message getting out very much that, you know, if you make these changes and burn less fossil fuel and emit less carbon dioxide, it wouldn't necessarily feel like a horrible sacrifice or like you were putting on a hair shirt, that there was a lot about it that I liked that I would do even if there wasn't a climate emergency, like the biking, like the gardening. I converted a car to run on waste vegetable oil. I'd probably just buy an electric car now, but back then that wasn't a viable option for me. So I really enjoyed all of these things.
You come to a conclusion, though, that the world population approaching 8 billion, your individual reduction obviously can't solve global warming. I mean, I interviewed a well-known environmentalist some time ago, and I asked him if he'd gotten an electric car or if he was reusing plastic bags or changed to LED light bulbs. And he said, yes, he does, but the real need, he said, is for a complete recalibration of the global economy, which does not seem to be happening. So are all these changes symbolic at an individual level?
What I'm doing is trying to push for a cultural shift. You know, I think that we look to our neighbors, our friends, our coworkers, and we kind of cue our behaviors off of them. And if no one is moving away from fossil fuel, that's not going to be something that we imagine. That's not going to be something that seems realistic to us. And it's not going to be something that we know how to do. So, you know, we need systems level change. I'm a huge advocate for making fossil fuel more expensive by putting a price on carbon, which is starting to gain some bipartisan support. But until there's a cultural shift and people really start voting on climate as an issue, it's very, very hard for elected officials to start making those changes.
Your decision not to fly is what's gotten the most attention and may be the hardest for a lot of people to go cold turkey on. It seems like even people who consider themselves environmentally conscious and otherwise find it hard to stop flying. Remind us how big a carbon footprint flying creates, like in your own time flying.
When I started making these changes, I was burning about the same as the U.S. average, which is around 20 tons of CO2 per year. And for me at the time, this was in 2010, flying was about 3/4 of my footprint. So
wow.
It was, for me, it was huge. And I had no idea until I sat down and looked at how my daily decisions were emitting CO2, and I quantified that. It didn't take me that long, and I talk about how to do that in my book. You know, I'm not calling for other people to give up flying altogether, and I would still fly if there was a compelling enough reason to get me on the plane, but I just don't like the feeling of emitting all that CO2. And since 2012, there hasn't been something that was compelling enough to get me back on a plane.
Has that been difficult? I mean, do you miss travel? I mean, you could drive to Paris, but it would take a long time.
Well, you know, I still travel. I'm very fortunate to live in California. There's so much to explore here. My parents and my wife's parents live in Illinois. So about once a year, we either take the train or drive, sometimes on vegetable oil, to Chicago. And we camp along the way, and it's a wonderful adventure.
By the way, 20 tons of CO2 per year, is that per person for the whole country?
Yeah, that's per person per year in
the
U.S.
That is insane.
And in Europe, it's about half of that. So I feel like there's a lot of low-hanging fruit for people in the U.S. to reduce their emissions. And then, you know, it's kind of like bicycle infrastructure. If no one's riding a bike, your city's probably not going to be that eager to put in bike lanes and bike paths. But, you know, it's like a chicken and egg thing. As more and more people start demanding alternatives to the fossil fueled infrastructure and the fossil fuel way of doing things, I think the systems will start to catch up.
Yeah, power in numbers. That's called a revolution. Help us out here. Not everyone lives in a place where they can bike everywhere or can give up flying altogether. What first step would you suggest for people who may want to reduce their carbon footprint but kind of don't know where to start?
Right. Well, absolutely. The first thing to do is to figure out how your actions are connected to CO2. For me, again, like I was all ready to put solar panels on my roof, which for me it would have been a long payback time at the time. And then when I actually sat down, I realized that my diet and flying were my two biggest things. Everyone's going to be different. You know, I haven't met a single person in my life who doesn't burn any fossil fuel whatsoever. So it's I think it's important not to get too puritanical about this, but to think instead, you know, what are the big things that I can reduce? So hopefully people can find something that makes them happier and also reduces their footprint. And then that's a sustainable change. And hopefully they'll be eager to try taking the second step.
Peter Kalmus is a climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, though he's been speaking with us on his own behalf, not NASA's. He joined us from member station KPCC in Pasadena. Peter, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.